Welcome to Special Sauce, SiriusEats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
When we opened at 5:15, and we booked the whole room again at 7, and we booked the whole room again between 8:15 and 8:45, and the whole room again at 9:45, and the whole room again at 10:30, and then we'd take walk-ins until 11:30.
This week, I am taking a trip down memory lane with an old friend, chef restaurateur, and force of nature, Mario Batali, co-owner of 26 restaurants all over the world, one of the Emmy Award-winning hosts of The Chew, one of the forces behind 4 of the American branches of the Italian food theme park, Eataly. And having gone to his wedding, I can tell you that Mario did wear shorts and his signature orange clogs as well. All right, my old friend, we got a lot of ground to cover here, including your new book, Mario Batali, Big American Cookbook, and your newest restaurant, a tapas bar. There's so many things I don't want to talk about. Like, we could do like an OJ mini series about you, like made in America and Italy,
That's right.
But here we are. First of all, tell us about life at the Batali family table growing up.
Well, when I was growing up, there were two sets of experiences. There was the go to grandma's on the weekend and go to the aunts and uncles on the holidays. And then there was the Monday to Friday and the regular dinners. Weekdays, mom, dad worked up until I was 9 or 10. Mom didn't work. And then when she did start working, the kids took over some of the cooking responsibilities. But pretty much dinner was on the table every night at 6 o'clock. We were simple. We didn't have very complicated meals, but we had delicious stuff. At least once a week, we had a pasta night, And that was just it. Like, you know, as opposed to the Italian way where you have pasta and then you have a main course and
right.
a salad and then all these other things, we would have pasta and a salad and a vegetable.
Right.
We always had once a week or once in the I guess you would call it the cycle, we would have a tongue.
Tongue.
We would have calf's liver. We would have ox tails.
No wonder you were one of the founders of nose-to-tail cooking.
Right. Well, because I think it wasn't that we were exotic. I think we were thrifty.
Right.
And, like, we associated each of those organ or offal meats with a particular bottled sauce. Tongue always had prime steak sauce. Calf's liver always had ketchup and red wine vinegar.
These are all right. to mask the flavor.
No, it was just like that was that got you into the game.
Got it.
Right?
Okay.
So we never looked at it as that weird, you know. We always had weird meats on the table, but we had pot roast and we had Sunday suppers that were maybe a little bit more elaborate, but dinner was always at 6. You had to be at the table. It wasn't an option. If the phone rang, which in the 60s and 70s, like, you would answer the phone, we did not answer the phone.
Really?
If someone knocked on the door, and this is the suburbs where people don't really knock on the door that much, you were not allowed to answer
wow.
the door.
Wow. So, like, dinner was serious.
Right.
It was sacred.
And it was just a time where you could sit down and your mom or your dad would say, all right, so who'd you sit next to at lunch? What was your funniest part? What was your disappointment today? And what are we going to do tomorrow? And, you know, there were games in our sporting events that our parents would always make. And it was pretty regular, I'd say,
yeah.
right out of Leave It to Beaver. You know, there was nothing unusual except that we were eating tongue, and then on the weekends we'd eat calf's brain raviolis at grandma's house.
Right. And, by the way, you ate a lot better than June and you did.
Right, exactly. I mean, we ate food that predominantly a lot of our stuff was foraged or pickled from our family's larder. You know, it was in the summer we would go to Yakima, or we lived in Yakima for 5 years, but we would go to the Lower Valley Market in the Yakima Valley.
Yakima, Washington, which is Eastern Washington.
Eastern Washington, where there used to be hops and tumbleweeds. Now there's Merlot and Croquet.
Of course.
And we would go and we would pickle whatever it was. You know, we would pickle Brussels sprouts. We would make dilly beans. We would make dill pickles, sweet pickles, pickled relish, pickled cabbage. Like, every one of the members of both my parents' sides of the family, all of my aunts and uncles, and subsequently all of my cousins, are picklers, foragers, fish smokers, you know, game bird dryers. Like, that was just part of our culture. And it was never in our intention to be Alice Waters or Sacred or Jeremiah Tower or Slow Food. It wasn't a movement.
Right.
It was just what we did. Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, I remember going to Don Christensen's house. We lived in a predominantly Northern European, Scandinavian. But, I mean, you know, by the time you get to Washington State, anybody's kind of natural roots were so far away. You were just so American.
Right.
Really, a lot of people didn't have that many real ethnic divisions. And certainly you didn't talk about anybody's religion. They just
right.
went to church. But, you know, I remember going to Don Christensen's house and seeing sausage in their fridge. And I'm like, you can buy this?
Now, who's he?
He was my next door neighbor. His dad was a pilot for United. His mom was a stewardess, and they were cool, and they had a Jaguar, and they were comfortable. And his dad, I remember seeing his dad eat a Walla Walla sweet onion like an apple, and I just thought, you know, we're not the weirdest people on this block.
And your dad was an engineer, right?
Engineer at Boeing.
And your mom, when your mom went to work, what did she do?
She was a registered nurse.
Got it.
She was the first registered nurse for Planned Parenthood.
Wow.
In Washington State.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was really cool.
So they were very serious about food and also... And
but it didn't seem serious. You
no,
know?
That's
my point. It wasn't like there were foodies.
Right.
And it wasn't like there were gastronomists.
Right.
But like, you know, when they did the big auction dinner for the, you know, the swim club... Like, people would buy it up. I mean, it probably went for $400 or $500 back in the days for 8 to 10 people. And they'd come over and mom and dad would cook like an 8 or 9 course meal.
Wow.
And it was legendary.
Yeah. But what's interesting is that you inherited that. You know, it's sort of – it wasn't – you know, I've never heard you articulate a philosophy. It's
no.
just a way to – think about food.
Right. It was always very natural for us. And in the same sense, like when we put something, when mom and dad would put something new on the table, it wasn't to a trumpet roll or, I mean, a trumpet sound or a drum roll. It was like, this is parsnips. And instead of saying, we hope you like them, it was just like parsnips were part of the meal. And if you didn't
right.
eat them, you were a little more hungry.
Right.
You know, it wasn't like, God, we're going to go exotic. You know, here's the kidneys. It was like, kidneys are for dinner. That's your only option. We're not considering this as a no.
Sure.
There's not even a polite, maybe I'll take one bite. It's like, that's dinner.
And how many siblings do you have?
I have a brother, Dana, and a sister, Gina.
So there were three of you. Did you guys, as you said, get involved in the kitchen and cooking pretty early?
Well, when mom went back to work, when I was 9, Dana was 7, Dana was 8 and Gina was 6, the announcement was made that each of us had to make a dinner once a week.
Wow.
To take some of the pressure off. Now, it could be anything. You know, it could be, at that point, there was a brand called Banquet Frozen
sure.
Chicken.
Sure.
All you had to
no
do
well.
Was, right? All you had to do was put that on the shopping list and then make the salad. We were homemade vinaigrette makers our whole lives. We never, ever, ever
had
bottled
salad dressing.
We wouldn't even know what it was. It was just like, you buy that stuff. So, so the kids each had to make it. It could be something like that. It could be as complicated as chili. It could be opening. We could have TV dinners if it was just the kids. Like, that was a luxury.
And there was no judgment.
No judgment. You could do whatever you want. You just had to play in the game. It was. But if the parents were going to be home that night, you couldn't have TV dinners. You had to make something that everyone would enjoy. And generally, you had to put together some kind of a vegetable, at least a salad and some other thing. And you submitted your shopping list when mom went shopping. And we often went all shopping together, a lot of times on Saturdays. Because Saturday morning was a good time. And that was it. And then mom still made dinners and dad still made a dinner or two. And, you know, on the weekends, it was like we lived in Sunset Magazine. We had like a red mahogany looking deck. We had a garden in the backyard. We had a quarter of a court basketball court with a hoop and a barbecue. And like we grilled whole salmons or we had, I think one of the greatest sounds that I'll ever remember is the confluence of listening to college football on the radio while we did our garden work at the same time as a spit roasting chicken was on the rotisserie on the barbecue.
That's
and
so
it's like
crazy.
When it would get a little caught and you'd listen to the Huskies either win or lose. Eventually they'd lose to Ohio State or Michigan in the Rose Bowl.
We
had a couple
did.
Of good years, but
right.
that's why my deep felt hatred for Woody Hayes still sleeps within me dormant.
So you went off to college and it was...
Well, there was a... Hold on.
Right.
Let's not skip Spain.
Right. That's right. Now, that's right, because your family... Did your family move to Spain?
Everybody did.
Right.
When Franco died, not related in any way to his death, my dad worked with Boeing and we had this fantastic opportunity. So I went to 10th, 11th, and 12th grade at the American School in Madrid. My brother went to 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. My sister went to 7th through 12th
wow.
grade to high school in Madrid. And this is right after Franco died. So it was watching an emerging democracy from 38 years of a true dictatorship. And it was just unbelievable. Now, Spanish food wasn't avant-garde back then. It was mostly burnt garlic and overcooked meat. But it was still odd and exotic and regional. And it was something that just opened our eyes to something fantastic, which is just the whole idea of gastronomic traveling. Whether it was just eating strawberries in Aranjuez or having paella in Valencia, it wasn't like there was no avant-garde at that point. But it was still delicious, and each place had its own dish. And for us, that was exotic because, like, if you travel the West Coast, everyone ate pretty good, but it wasn't anything fancy. And we weren't eating at Chez Panisse,
right.
And we weren't eating at,
sure.
You know, the 5-star restaurants.
And that's interesting because all of that really went into your cooking and thinking. Right. And most people don't have that background.
Right.
And, you know, I think people take it for granted that, you know, the path to becoming a chef is just one path. And
right.
Your path is actually very different and very organic.
Right.
In a way that many chefs aren't.
Well, when I was starting to apply for college, I remember my mom saying, well, why don't you think about going to cooking school? Because I loved, like, making, like, fancy grilled cheese sandwiches with caramelized onions and manchego and jamon, you know, jamon ibérico. And, like, we always cooked together. And, like, on our New Year's Day at our house, especially in Spain, we would make 100 pounds of sausage that would last us for a long time.
Wow.
And we'd freeze it and cure it and preserve it in oil and all of these other things. And it was just what we did. And I really enjoyed it. And to her credit, Mom really figured that out early. And I just thought, no way. I had just seen Animal House. And there was no way I was not going to get this university experience that looked like so much fun in John Belushi's hands. So I, and in retrospect, I would say that the partying component is one, but that the liberal arts education makes everybody perform better in life later on. And that not only does it make them more fascinating, but it gives them a chance to find something that fascinates them.
Yeah.
And I would suggest it when young kids tell me, I want to become a chef or a cook, I say, well, first of all, you're going to work hard. Second of all, if you really love it, you're going to never feel like you're at work. And third of all, get a basic liberal arts education in something that has nothing to do with the culinary arts. So you have something to talk about when you're sitting around cooking.
Right.
Besides just cooking, because that's what makes cooking more interesting. If you look at the collaboration with people that maybe you don't even love them, you're working with somebody and it's important that you work together, kind of like I imagine what the political situation should be right now.
Right.
You don't have to love everybody.
Right.
But there is a time when you have to put some things beside and let's get something done that works together. A dinner rush is exactly that situation.
Right.
So when you work together with someone and you collaborate and at the end of the day you can look back and on that very specific day you have achieved everything as opposed to these long lead projects that a lot of businesses have to do, there is such a visceral success. Success on every day that I realized then in college while I was making my pocket money at Stuff Your Face in New Brunswick, New Jersey, that this was going to be something I loved more than anything I was studying.
And you were studying literature, right?
I was studying Spanish theater and I was studying financial portfolio theory.
Right. It's funny. What a bizarre combination, Spanish theater and portfolio theory. But you once told me that if you didn't become a chef that you had thought about becoming a banker at one point, right?
Well, that was, you know, what I really wanted to do is I had fallen in love so much with Spain and had met so many pretty cool both Americans and Spaniards. I just wanted to kind of live in a house that somebody else paid for, have a staff, have a car, and work in Spain. And it seemed that most of those jobs were somewhere in the financial industry.
Got it.
It wasn't that I loved banking because I didn't really understand it, but I did understand and like economics.
Right.
And the theory of economics was interesting. I think the banking world might have eaten me alive. I don't think I could have survived it. But that is to say, the banking world is a fascinating field.
Yeah, yeah.
And in Machiavellian spirit, I might have done well.
Exactly. And your own extremely genial way, you're a very competitive person. So I bet you would have done really, really well.
Well, that's what I always say when we're at the Chew and they say, this is not a competition. Then I always say, well, if this isn't a competition, do you mind if I win?
Exactly.
A quick shout out to one of our sponsors who brings you this message. HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. HelloFresh sources the freshest ingredients, measured to the exact quantities needed to eliminate food waste, and offers step-by-step recipes for delicious meals designed to take around 30 minutes to make, all of which are approved by 2 registered dietitians on staff. And everything is delivered in a special insulated box, always with free shipping. For $35 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter the promo code SERIOUSEATS when you subscribe.
So when did the chef light bulb go off?
when I was in college, I was working at this place called Stuff Your Face, and it was just...
It was a pizzeria, right?
It was a pizzeria that made stromboli in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and it's still quite famous, I think, as a college food hangout. It's... everything they make is delicious. Everything they made was fresh. Everything you did was made by hand. And that was a valuable lesson in that you could make something fresh, hot. And it was like, I believe the large one was 4 and the huge one was 8. And it was enough food and it was something that was good and integrated that even the college kids in the neighborhood, aside from the price, realized that it was something good for you. And I just kind of loved the idea. So by the time I was graduating, I realized, well, I don't really want to go into banking. And there are no jobs in Spanish theater of the Golden Age except for teaching. And I didn't think I wanted to teach. So I thought this would be a great experience. Let me apply to the Cordon Bleu. And I did. And they accepted me for the semester starting in 1983 in the end of spring. So I had 1 year and I just stayed working at Stuff Your Face after my summer vacation.
Right. Interesting. And then you started a whole bunch of cooking apprenticeships, right, in restaurants, hotel restaurants. You had a stint.
Well, first I worked for Marco Pierre White in London.
So that in itself could be an episode of Special Sauce.
Yes, it could.
You did tell me one of the now – what's now become a pretty famous story about I believe it was a hotel pan of lasagna.
No, it was a sauté pan of risotto.
Oh, okay. So what happened to this sauté pan?
Well, I was making risotto for a side dish, which, of course, is not Italian. A side dish is something that goes along the side of something. Risotto and pasta are unique in the primo department.
Sure.
They're their own course. So it was all right. I wasn't offended by that yet. But I was making it, and I had tasted risotto before, and I handed it to Marco because I was working on the line next to him, and he sent it back and said, this isn't cooked. I said, no, Marco, that's exactly how it should be cooked. He said, no, I want you to cook it more. I said, no. I think it's just right. And he said, are you challenging me? I said, I'm not challenging you. I'm just telling you this is how risotto is supposed to taste. He took another taste of it, and he said, take it back. And he threw a whole pan and hit me in the chest from like 4 feet away, like maybe a quart and a half or 2 quarts of very hot risotto in a hot pan, hit me in the chest, splashed up on me. Didn't really burn me. I mean, a couple of splatters on my neck. And I
don't see
him.
The scars.
No scars. And I was taken aback, and I looked at him, and I said, you son of a bitch, under my breath. And I walked back into the back kitchen. I took off my apron. I put it down. I walked up to the front where the sauces were. Most of our sauces at that point were – there was one reduced chicken stock, and there were 5 mother sauces based on beurre blanc and 1 suspension based on a hollandaise. And I took a big handful of salt and stirred one into each sauce and walked off the line and said, goodbye, Marco. And that was it. And I didn't talk to him for 20 years until Bill Buford contacted him to talk about heat.
Heat, right, which we'll get to in a second.
Right.
That's amazing.
But that was – I worked for him for 6 months, and I can say that you are as likely to learn from a really talented person what to do as you are to learn what not to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned a lot about interpersonal skills and how to manage people properly, which is generally with a carrot, not a whip.
Right. Yeah. And then you were at the Four Seasons. You ended up at a Four Seasons,
right? I ended up at a San Francisco Four Seasons, The Clift, for a fantastic guy named Kelly Mills, working with a general manager called Stan Bromley and the food and beverage guy named Robert Chima, all of whom I still stay in touch with. Fantastic guys, corporate guys, a little different. They gave me some creativity, but they kept me under wraps, and it was a great experience. Living in San Francisco was fantastic. You know, I did a little prep work at Stars because I was just basically a bar regular there.
Right. Stars was the legendary restaurant that Jeremiah Tower opened in San Francisco.
A lot of my friends worked for Brad Ogden at Campton Place. I knew Judy Rogers.
These are all important American chefs living in and working in San Francisco.
In the late 80s.
Yes.
And this was kind of the renaissance of California cuisine. Its real roots were there, and everyone was excited, and the markets were building, and people were understanding the local stuff. The Chino Farm was becoming a big thing. Wolfgang Puck was exploding in California. It was the most exciting time.
It was like the epicenter.
Right, exactly. So meeting people at that time was just, it was very much... It was a building point for a lot of people's careers who I still know. And a lot of them have burned out and gone on the wayside, and a lot of them are still around, like Michael Mina and Bruce Hill. And, you know, a lot of my friends that I still love are still in the game and loving it. And it was a fantastic time to live in San Francisco.
That's great. When I met you, you were cooking at this sort of celebrity haunt hangout in New York, right?
Yes.
It was called...
K Café Tabac.
Café Tabac, right. And we always used to read about Madonna eating at Café Tabac.
Madonna, Helena Christensen, Linda Evangelista, all the supermodels and really famous people. Mick Jagger was in there. I mean, it was a very groovy place where they had the highly exclusive second floor.
Right.
That you had to get by this maitre d' guy named Tim, who was very cool. And he kind of decided whether you were groovy enough or not groovy
Got
enough.
It.
And the owner was a guy named Roy Liebenthal, who was still around and in the business, but his super strength was those years of this very hot club that was... It was a very cool place. The food wasn't anything that anybody really cared about, so I was just cooking my little balls off, but I wasn't really succeeding that well.
Yeah.
Before that, I had been at Rocco, though.
Which was the legendary Italian, old-school Italian restaurant.
Joint.
And you did succeed in making that menu more contemporary.
I made one of my largest mistakes by completely changing the menu overnight. And I would have probably done better from a financial point of view to change about half the menu and keep about half the menu so I wouldn't have alienated every single customer that had gone in there in one day. So they'd come in and the waiters would say, oh, this is our new stuff. And it was like, can I still get the old stuff? And they would try to figure out a way to tell the customer something and then tell me something so they could get the dishes that they wanted to, which I would have – I was so foolish. I have learned subsequently that I should have gone in and gone halfway and started enticing them with new dishes and maybe tasting them on little tastes and saying, look at all this fancy new stuff I can do.
So I met you through your future wife.
Yes.
When you were just going out, Susie Kahn,
yep.
Whose parents we both adore.
Yep.
Mom died and you say her dad is in ill health as we are speaking.
He's still kicking.
And you were...
And they own Coach Farm.
Yeah, they own Coach.
Which was one of the first farm-to-table, true local products, along with the beginning of D'Artagnan and the mushroom guys at Odalis and a couple of other producers that were just all aligned philosophically, but they didn't build their businesses in cahoots.
No.
But they were just kind of lumped together, and they were all at the Green Market, and it was a very interesting time in New York. This is when Gotham was really hot, and, you know, Charlie Palmer was coming out of the barrel, and David Burke was hatching. It was a very exciting time in the beginning of the 90s when New York restaurants were really exploding.
And Miles Kahn, whom I adore,
95
now, told me that, A, he had owned Coach Leather and sold it and then decided he would retire by opening a little goat farm.
Yeah.
Little did he know how much work that was.
Right.
And that he would literally go door to door because there was no local goat cheese on the East Coast until Lillian and Miles
built this stuff.
Had Coach.
And they did it French style, and it was all handmade.
Yeah, it was
no
amazing.
No cryovac and no machinery. It was a delicious and magnificent representation of the Hudson Valley, French ideology, and the magnificent goat milk that they were able to get out
way
of their
ahead
alpines.
Of its time.
Way ahead of its time.
And I remember you got married there.
Yes.
And yes, folks, he did wear his clogs and shorts at the wedding.
I did.
And it was an awesome wedding, and that's the most beautiful piece of land.
Still there.
Oh, my God, it's
still
stunning.
Fantastic.
So then you decide you're going to open your own restaurant, right? You don't have a lot of money.
I had no money.
Okay, so no money is definitely not a lot of money.
Right, exactly.
And you open Poe with a partner.
In 1993.
32 seats if you include—
34.
With the
two bar seats.
Right, with a few bar seats.
Right.
And yet there was something, I don't know what it is. I've been trying to put my finger on it since I knew I was going to talk to you. It's like, what made Poe so special? You unleashed something. It was the beginning of the energy that became Babbo.
Right.
You know, it had that amazing energy. And probably for you, even though you were cooking in a as far as I can tell, a 6x6.
The kitchen was 10x10 without equipment.
Oh, okay.
So by the time you got in the kitchen, it was like 6x5.
Right.
All
so
loaded.
6x5, 34 seats.
Yeah.
And you once told me that you did over 200 covers in one night.
Yeah.
How is that possible?
Well,
At that point, I had help.
But, you know, we were busy and I had, and we had a good little buzz going. Keep in mind back then, my six-course tasting menu, an antipasto, two pastas, main course, cheese, and dessert, was $29.
I know.
Our appetizers were $8, Our pastas were 10 to 12, and our entrees were 15. It was, you couldn't not go there. And it was, for a lot of people, I remember when David Halberstam kind of discovered us. For him, it was the dream to have a little hole in the wall in the village that you could go down to and have something better than Little Italy, a little more fresh, a little younger, a little hipper vibe, a little rock and roll on the stereo. And if you knew us, you could just get in whenever you wanted. I mean, we didn't know very many people. So, you know, we got busy after we got an Eric Asimov Under 25 review on August 26, 1993.
Wow.
And it blew our doors off. And we've been thankful for Eric ever since. It was one of the great reviews of my life. They just really enjoyed the experience. And people understood that it was value, that there was, you could take a reservation. And we booked the whole room when we opened at 5:15. And we booked the whole room again at 7. And we booked the whole room again between 8:15 and 8:45. And the whole room again at 9:45. And the whole room again at 10:30. And then we'd take walk-ins until 11:30. So that's how you could do 6-7 turns when you really needed to. Because a lot of people just come in and have a $10 bowl of gnocchi with oxtails and have a salad and a dessert. And you could leave in 45 minutes because the food was fast, because I'm a fast line cook.
You are a fast line cook. I'll never forget when I brought my 7-year-old son and his friend Louisa.
I remember.
And Louisa said, "I like pancakes." And you said, "This is an Italian restaurant. We don't serve pancakes." And whatever you gave her, she loved. That's all I remember.
I gave her gnocchi pomodoro. And she was very happy about that because they were soft like a pancake.
That's awesome. It is, you know, people forget, or if they're new to the food world, I think Poe is an underrepresented part of the your history, but also the history of Italian food in New York. You know, because there was that energy and you did give it a contemporary spin, and there was just a glow to that restaurant that was just undefinably wonderful.
Right. That made people happy.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, one of the things about building a menu at that time was, as long as I had like linguine with clams and some kind of piccata, like a veal piccata or a monkfish piccata, and some kind of salami or prosciutto, and some kind of dessert with, I did a warm apple tart with a vanilla ice cream, but we also did a sundae, which was a mint ice cream with chocolate syrup and some kind of toasted pine nuts.
But like, you never had a pastry chef.
No, we never had a pastry chef. And we never. I mean, I made all the desserts. I made the desserts or the prep cook. Eventually, we opened for lunch, and eventually I had a AM sous chef and a PM sous chef, so I would be able to walk off the line every now and then and go say hello to people.
Well, I remember—
Andy Nusser. That's when Andy Nusser started.
Yes, Andy Nusser, who became the opening chef at Babbo, and then—
Opening chef at Casamono and partner,
and
now
in
Terry Lodge.
I just ate in New Haven. I'll tell you about that at the Terry Lodge. But I remember going back into that kitchen, because we did know each other a little then— and just being amazed at the ballet that was that kitchen, in that tiny space, turning out that quality of food to that many customers in one night.
It was a lot of fun.
It must have been like putting on a show every night.
Right. Well, and also, you know, you get into that rhythm and all of a sudden it's all you're thinking about. And you could, at that point, it was almost like jazz music. I could look up and talk to customers while I was plating a six top, and it didn't really bother me or stop me. And people knew if they went back to the bathroom and stuck their head around that little sliding saloon door, they could say hello, and I would say hello. And unless I was really in some kind of a weird fit, I was more than cordial, and I just didn't want them to fall down the staircase, which is right there to the right when you walked in. But that's where I answered the phone during most of my morning prep shift, because the phone was over there, and I'd take reservations, then go back over there and work. It was the original kind of two-man gig.
Yes, exactly. That's funny. Well, look, there's so many things I want to talk to you about. I know you have to go, but will you come back? Because I want to talk about so many other things, Babbo and TV and all that. So just—
Anytime, Ed. I'm always available.
Mario Batali, thank you. We'll see you next week, Serious Eaters.